Hi there, and welcome to the very first edition of Victory Labs, part of the Throwback Thursday celebrations for the 50th anniversary of Riverside International Speedway. I'm Dylan Langell, a big auto racing fan who started off playing with toy cars on the mat on the floor. I still do from time to time, but now it's seeing the big cars at Riverside. The whole concept of Victory Labs is really all in the title, celebrating. We are celebrating what John Chisholm's vision was and continues to be at Riverside, but also keeping you in the know on the latest info for 2019, including the dates you need to mark on your calendar. By the way, start booking your vacation for August 16th and 17th for the NASCAR Pinty Series weekend, and of course July 18th through the 20th for the IWK 250 weekend. We're really putting the pedal to the metal for the first episode of Victory Labs. Whether you know him by his full name or his nickname, Jerry Lawrence has a large presence at Riverside. Even though he suffered from polio at the age of 12, that did not stop Jerry from conquering the radio world, the political world, and of course, the race world. Maritime Motorsports Hall of Fame member Jerry Lawrence joins me for the first round of Victory Laps. Former MLA, announcer, radio host, jack of all trades, Jer Bear, Jerry Lawrence joining me for the first edition of Victory Laps at Riverside International Speedway. How you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing great. I'm living the dream, I guess. My wife and I and the cat, so we're here in Halifax, and we follow racing quite a bit, and it's what everybody dreams about, having a place that you can call home and have somebody else do all the work.
Exactly. So what we're doing with this podcast is celebrating the 50th anniversary of Riverside International Speedway, but also talking about the people at the track and working behind the scenes and also racing. And we figured, why not start with the original voice of Riverside? But let's just go back a little bit. Many people in the Halifax area would know you from Hello Metro, and it's a show that I've heard about so much. Can you just give me a little detail about how you got your start in the broadcasting industry?
Well, I always, as everybody I guess knows now, I got polio in 1951. I was 12 years old, but I always had an interest in radio. I went to CJCH as an operator, and they hired on a morning man, a number of them, but the last one that I worked with was Dave Nyma, a guy from New Glasgow, and I was his operator. He was the morning announcer. And he said to me, I'm going to get you on the radio one of these days. I said, yeah, I don't think so. I said, I am. So that would have been in the early 60s. And one weekend, 1964, I think it was, he called me on a Saturday afternoon and said, tonight's your night. I said, for what? He said, you're going on the radio tonight, because the guy that's doing that Saturday night show can't make it, so you're on. So, God, I went on the air, and, of course, all the relatives listened, and Monday morning they thought, everybody seemed to anyway, thought it was a good show, and so I enjoyed it. And I went on the air in 1964 and was quite fortunate in being on the air and on the morning show at CJ for until 1976.
And you went from there right up until about the mid-90s. And one thing I really love is hearing your prank calls. And I just heard one about calling a lady about a dog. And I love hearing that with the sound effects and everything.
People would tell me, they'd say, you know, come to the bridge. I can tell who's listening to you. Because people listening to the CBC get a mat on, their faces straight and everything. But people listening to you, they're throwing the money in the bridge bucket and they're laughing to kill themselves.
Now, let's get into the racing, Jerry. So were you always a racing fan growing up a little younger, or did it something just come a little later, maybe when you got towards the broadcasting game?
No, after I got polio, my dad and I were great buddies. It was only myself and my brother Bob, who was deceased. He was older than me, but my dad and I always had a passion for racing. And on Saturday afternoons, we used to go to the old Sackville Raceway, where the shopping center is now in Sackville. And we used to go out there on Saturday afternoons and have a blast. It was, in fact, we do have some clips of the old track. It was a dirt track. And they were racing like 1944s, 1938 Chevs, and old Hudsons and stuff. So we used to go out there, my dad and I, and we had a great time going out to the races. I was always interested in cars, always had an interest in cars. And I got a call one day from Doug Lively in Sackville. Doug had started a racetrack out in Sackville called Drag City. He called me one day at the radio station and said, "Look, can I meet you? Can I take you for a drive tonight after supper?" And I said, "Sure." So, and I'd never done announcing really at a racetrack before, so I said, "Sure." So anyway, I started at Drag City, and I was there for as long as the track lasted. Back in 1960, that would have been 68. In 69, I got a call from John Chisholm from Antigonish, and he said, "I'm building a track down in Antigonish. I'd like you to do my weekend announcing for me." And so I went down, I met with him, and we cemented a relationship that continued until he passed away here 3 or 4 years ago. He was a great guy and treated me well, and he appreciated what I did at the track. And that's how I get into stock car racing.
So the Riverside in 1969, that just kind of fell in your laps, essentially? Like John got word about what you were doing at Drag City?
Yeah, I just fell into it, and it just kept going, and I enjoyed it, and our three boys enjoyed it. They were basically only babies then, but Sheila and I and the three boys, that we piled into the Suburban and head down to Antigonish. And that's how I got involved with Riverside Speedway.
So 1969, just to maybe jog your memory a bit, what was some of the bigger songs back then when the track would have first opened as a DJ?
Oh my God, in 69. Well, I played mostly country music, so I was into Webb Pierce and Buck Owens and Hank Snow and Hank Williams and all these, you know, all the country music. My show basically was a country music show. So all the big songs that they had back in the day in 1969, I played, and I was familiar. And I played this. I used to make up tapes and take them with me to Riverside, and we played them over the PA system, you know.
And the fans loved the country?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh, yeah, yeah. The country music, I think it's synonymous that country music goes with car racing, I think. That's my own opinion, you know.
Compared to other tracks, I know there were Seabreeze and Lawrencetown and then the track in Sackville. You go to Riverside, the high banks, similar to Bristol Motor Speedway down in Tennessee. What was your first thoughts approaching Riverside in Antigonish?
Well, I had never seen the track, and at that time, back in 69, you couldn't get into the track as you can now. From an exit. There was no exit. You had to turn off at Marshy Hope, which is back about 3 or 4 miles from the track, and then take the old number 4 highway and come in over the bridge to the track. So when I first went down, I couldn't believe this high-banked oval here in the middle of basically nowhere. It's like John Chisholm. He owned Nova Construction, of course, and he built it. And knew exactly what he was doing. He had a helicopter, and he used to fly back and forth to Bristol and talk to all the NASCAR guys down there. So that's how he come to make the track as close as he could to a NASCAR track. But I was impressed, and certainly the drivers were impressed at the time.
And how big of a deal was it with the drivers? You know, you're going for maybe small quarter mile, maybe a bit less, maybe not a lot of banking, and then you go to essentially a behemoth of a track that's brand new. Did a lot of drivers comment on just maybe more be difficult or whatnot?
Oh yeah, I mean it taught a lot of these drivers who were racing down in Harbor Bushy and Fraser's Mountain. And even at Drake City, the high banks, I mean, it taught them how to drive a race car. It didn't take them long to learn, I can tell you that. But that's where most of the drivers around here got their talent.
And one of the first celebrity drivers at Riverside was the late, great Benny Parsons. Do you have any memories of BP coming to Riverside?
Oh, yeah. Benny was he was quite a guy. I met Benny Parsons. He raced there, and he also raced at Shubenacadie at the Motorsport Park there.
Yeah.
And so he was just a nice guy. I tell you, who's similar to him is Kenny Wallace.
Right.
They almost had the same kind of personality. So he was one of the early ones. Earl Ross was another one, and of course Junior Henley. And the first Riverside 250 that we had back in 1976-77, we invited everybody to come, and just about everybody did. All the East Coast U.S. guys came, Quebec, Jean-Paul Cabana from Ontario, Henley and Biederman and these guys, and they were all impressed with the track. But, I mean, when you compare that track now to what you have, it's just different altogether, you know, because they had guardrail for the track and outside. Now it's all cement, so it was a different thing altogether. But it certainly was impressive when you had a race there.
And you actually kind of fast forwarded it for me as well. I was going to go into 1977. You become the track promoter with Ron King. How did that come about, being the track promoter?
Well, Ronnie, he was always hanging around Atlantic Speedway, and we approached Jim Corbett because Ronnie and I had talked for a couple of weeks coming into the end of the season at Atlantic, saying, you know, God, we should really put on a big, you know, the weather's good, September, what a good time for a race. And we tried to rent the track from Jim, and he didn't want to do that. He said, no, it'll hurt my attendance for the weekly racing and so on and so forth. So I called John Chisholm, and the track basically had been shut down. Nobody was really using it. And he said, what do you need? And I said, well, we're going to need some of this, some of that, some bathrooms at work, and so on and so forth. And my wife, Sheila, and I, and friends, and the boys, we all went down. We painted all the guardrail, and we did everything that we could to get the thing started. And then we put out a press release that, this is going to be the biggest race ever in Atlantic Canada, Eastern Canada anyway. And we invited all these drivers to come, and they came. I mean, they looked at the track and thought it was awesome. And that's basically how the thing got started to to explode, you know.
And that was unprecedented, almost 250 laps on a speedway that size. Were a lot of drivers intimidated with this gigantic race?
Oh, yeah, they were. And what we decided to do, Ronnie and I, and Ronnie King and I, we decided to split it up into two 125s. So we didn't have straight through 250. We had two 125s, which worked out better because a lot of the cars that didn't make it in the first 125, they had a chance to get into the second one. So, it was the biggest crowd I'd ever seen at that point at Riverside Speedway.
What were some of the drivers, like you just mentioned Junior Henley, and there's others like Frank Frazier, there's other Maritime and Canadian drivers. Were there some colorful personalities around the track that really made it special for the fans?
Oh, yeah. Well, Jean-Paul Cabana from Quebec, he was one of the stars that came. And, of course, Henley and Biederman and all these guys, the guys from the States, Dave Dion, the Dragon brothers, Beaver and Bobby Dragon. And it brought, it brought a new flavor to stock car racing in Atlantic Canada, having all these drivers come. And they were top-notch drivers. I mean, Dave Dion went on to be one of the best. Dick McCabe was another one, all from Maine. And, of course, up there in Maine and New Hampshire, they call them cars. They don't call them cars. They call them race cars.
Like car keys?
Yeah, like
car
keys.
Yeah.
That's right. And so it was great having them, and it just turned out to be a success. And it continued right through, so you see what you've got today. And through it all, John Chisholm, John Nova, he owned Nova Construction, so that's how he separated his name from the other John Chisholm. Everybody called him John Nova. And he was just a great guy and a great, and he raced himself, of course.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He had the big number 88. He used to get he had a Mustang, and he got them from Holman Moody down south.
Yeah.
And he'd have them shipped up, and then I think he had a Camaro at one point, but the Holman Moody Mustang, the big orange Mustang with the number 88 on the side, that was the big one. And he would, at Atlantic Speedway, he'd come in, he would bring the race car in on his deck truck, on his ramp truck, And people would say, you know, where is he? Where is he? They're almost getting ready to start. And he can see the helicopter coming, and he'd come and he'd land right in the middle of the track, right in the middle of the infield. And he'd get out, already have his racing suit on. And so he was a colorful
He was
guy.
Ready to go.
Oh, ready to go. And he meant so much to the racing in our area. Him and the guys like Doug Lively, Jim Corbett, all these people, and the people at Seabreeze Auto Raceway, even though they didn't have really much to work with, I always put on a good show there, too. So all these people together, it was the nucleus of a great stock car circuit in Atlantic Canada.
And how important was Riverside for the drivers to have such a beautiful facility back then and even now?
Well, it gave them something to bite on. I mean, they didn't have to go to Toronto or Ontario or Quebec or Maine or anywhere, because we had one of the best, if not the best, racing facilities in the whole area. So the people loved it, and the drivers thought it was awesome. They, you know, setting up their cars and all this kind of thing. So it was, but then, you know, I mean, even the safety crews then, compared to what there is now, there's no comparison. I mean, you've got your ambulance and all your first responders. Back in then, back in 69, 70, 70, mid-70s, you know, they used, some of them just used a pickup truck if you got hurt, you know. So everything turned around when John Chisholm redid the track back in 2006. He certainly brought everything to the front.
So we fast forward a bit to 2006. John Chisholm gets the track again and does a complete uplift, tears the track practically right to the ground with the banking and everything. Yeah. And when everything is rebuilt, Jer Bear comes back in 2006. How did that come about?
Well, he called me one day and he said, "Did you know I'm doing this with the track?" And I guess before then, a couple of years before 2006, I met him one night up in Moncton, up at Petty Raceway, and I said, "You know, you should be buying that track back, and you should be, you know, trying to get it back and working again, because it's, you know, it's the track." And he said, "Yeah, but," he said, "you know, I don't think I have this recipe for the same asphalt mix that I had back then." But he said, "I'm working on a couple of things." So I never thought any more about it. And then one day he called me, and he and I talked many, many, many times during the evening and the afternoons. I'd be laying down because I was still doing the morning show, and Sheila would come and she'd say, "John Nova's on the phone. He wants to speak with you." So anyway, he'd talk for half an hour, an hour, and he said, "You know, we're having this big grand opening, and I'd like you to come down that day or that night and be the announcing like you were before. I think you can do it." I said, "Sure, I'll be down." So anyway, I came down, and they had the big grand opening, and it was a great festive mood and so on and so forth, and then it just continued from there.
I want to ask about some funny stories about working at Riverside, and I heard about this one through the grapevine that you may have been left up in the tower after a night at the races. Do you remember that at all,
well,
Jerry?
The track down there, it was straight up again, but the ladder was on the outside of the building at Riverside. It was in the middle of the building, inside the building. But anyway, it was straight up. And John Nova said originally, when I first went down, he said, "How are you going to get up there?" And I said, "Well, I'll get up there." And I said, "I'll leave the crutches here." And then I said, "I can get up, that's no problem." But I said, "After the races, like somebody to give me a hand down, you know, get the crutches and so on and so forth." So after the race, I sat up there by myself. And I kept hollering and saying, you know, "Can somebody bring the crutches up so I can get down off the vertical?" Nobody did. So I sort of just did a crawl over to the ladder and get down myself. So we all had a big laugh about that. But it happened twice, the first time and the last time, because I didn't trust them after that.
Oh, wow. And just some other memories as well, Jerry. We lost Jim Seward. And he raced all over the Maritimes, including at Riverside. Do you have any memories of Jim driving at Riverside?
Well, Jim was back in those days, you know, I mean, there were a number of stars, if you want to call them stars, Terry Clattenburg and all these guys, and Jim was certainly right up there, Jim and his brother Greg. Greg sort of followed in Jim's footsteps, but Jim Stewart, when he came to the track, he won a lot of races. And the reason he won a lot of races because he was Jim Stewart. He knew how to set up a car. He knew he followed the construction of the car. Was an awesome driver. I can't remember seeing him in very many wrecks because he avoided them. He was a super driver, and just a super guy to be with and to listen to. And everybody is missing him as we speak.
And some other memories you mentioned briefly of how important John Nova, John Chisholm was. Any memories of really working with John, even right up until the end?
Oh, yeah. John, when we started to think about Ron King and I about starting this 250, I said, John, we have to do something with the guardrails and the seats. We have to renew the seats. So I worked a deal with Russell White Lumber up in Kennecook, and he provided all the lumber, and John's crew put all the new seats in and all this kind of thing. John put all new plumbing in the place, and toilets and sinks and the whole thing. And about a week before the race, John called me one day and he said, "We got some bad news." I said, "Oh God, what's the bad news?" He said somebody broke in and stole all the pipes and the electrical conduit. And this is like a week before the race. And he said, don't worry. It'll be all done. I got it half done already. So that's the kind of guy he was, you know. When I said about making this big race, Ronnie King and I, the only thing he said to me, what do you need? And whatever we said we needed, he got for us. So he wanted to see it like that and a big race just as much as we did. So, but he was the driving force. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Jerry, just a couple more questions before we wrap it up here. Just announcing in Riverside, what was that like for the first couple times and when you continued through the years?
Well, I found that they were all my friends. I had never met these people before. Joey Baker and Danny Sampson and these guys, I had never met them before, and they all sort of just worked together, and I worked with them, and I got to know them. I got to know their families, told a few stories about them over the PA, and they enjoyed it, and I just enjoyed doing it. It was just a lot of fun.
And was that almost the key to your success, having fun at work announcing racing?
Oh yeah, and you see that being a race car announcer for me, being on the radio. I mean, I could drop names all the time on the air of Frank Fraser and Terry Clattenburg and these guys and Jim Hallahan, and then people would say, "Oh God, I heard the bear talking about you on the radio," and one just led into the other, and it was the best thing that I ever did to promote my radio career, for sure.
And what do you think your legacy is at Riverside International Speedway?
I don't really know. I guess just trying to do a good job for the track owners and the track owner, and leaving there and saying, gee, you know, I think I did a pretty good job. And, of course, my wife, Sheila. She was the other partner in this, and if it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't even have been doing it, because she used to get the boys all ready to go down there to do the racing. And when they get down, they were the program sellers, Michael, Peter, and Patty. They sold the programs, which I promoted and I printed. And in fact, Patty and I, when he was a little guy, we used to go all the way down to the street two or three times a week selling ads in the program. And so it was a family affair, and on the way home, Sheila would come into the last lap of the feature race. She would get them in the Suburban and get their pajamas on. They'd sleep all the way home. We'd get home about 1 o'clock in the morning, and that would be Saturday night, and Sunday morning we'd sleep in a little bit.
It'd be a labor of love.
Oh, yeah, and Sheila's just, you know, I marry the girl next door, and she's just two of us enjoyed it immensely. Even now, we go to the races and still enjoy them. You know.
Will we see you at Riverside this year, celebrating the 50th anniversary?
Oh, I'll be hanging around somewhere. Yep, I'll be sitting in the corner somewhere, turning four, eating a hot dog or something. But, oh, yeah, we'll be there for sure.
I hope to make your acquaintance this summer. Jerry, Jer Bear, it's been a pleasure talking to you on the first episode of Victory Laps, the 50th anniversary for Riverside International Speedway. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, Riverside is not losing out on you because you've got a great voice, and I wish you well in your career.
Well, thank you very much, Jerry. Take care, my friend.
Okay.
It was an honor and a privilege to chat with Jer Bear. When I went to radio school, Jerry's name came up a lot, and you can certainly see why. Before the checkered flag waves, the Whites got away first. Just some housekeeping notes, starting off with campsite reservations for the IWK 250 weekend. If you want the same site you had in 2018, the exact same spot you had last year, go online to riversidespeedway.ca and renew your campsite. New campsite reservations are also open. They'll be taken care of after the renewals, but it's first come, first serve, so book that as soon as possible. As of recording this, only a few events have been confirmed on the calendar, including the NASCAR Pinty Series event on the weekend of August 16th and 17th. The only stop in Atlantic Canada for the Pinty Series, the Bumper to Bumper 300. And the excitement continues to build for the marquee event at Riverside, the IWK 250 presented by Steve Lewis. Kicking things off with a tailgate party on Thursday, July 18th, racing on Friday, July 19th, and then the premier event on Saturday, July 20th, the IWK 250 presented by Steve Lewis. More details to come as the weather gets warmer, and for any other questions, you can find the contact info at riversidespeedway.ca. Thank you very much for checking out the first edition of Victory Laps. The checkered flag is waving. I'm Dylan Angel, and we'll see you next time.